Welcome to the Combat Radio Network. This is Three Men and a Microphone, recorded inside the Iron Mike Studio, located in the Military Exchange on Route 332 in Canandaigua. Three Men and a Microphone is an opinion show based on the ins and outs, the news, politics, and scuttlebutt about town and the city of Canandaigua. Beautiful, historical Canandaigua, New York, where the hops grow higher, the grapes grow sweeter, and the sun always shines. In conjunction with 1310 AM, Canandaigua. Three men and a microphone, all the way from Rochester to Geneva, New York. I am your host, Corporal Tim Thornton, and this is Three Men and a Microphone. And we'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned. When we come back from this commercial break, we'll be back with the Irish-American culture from Rochester, New York, with Mr. Michael McCarthy. And we'll find out what old Corliss used to say to the ladies.
How far? Yeah. No clue. I went to school with the Duffys and the McGoldricks, and my wrestling and football coach was a Quinn, and I never heard that one before.
So, yeah, that's...
Sorry.
That night, and I gotta say, he had a pickup line that was horrible. And it was horrible because it worked. He would lean into the girls and say, "You know, lass, we have flowers in Ireland, but they're not half as pretty as you are." Ooh, well. And they would kiss him immediately. It was awful. Just awful.
Now, how's that line go again?
I need to write that one down word for word now.
So tell us more. There's a lot of things I'm sure you guys get involved in the Irish Cultural Institute.
Right.
Well, interesting to know you call it Irish American.
Yes. Yes. When we do make that distinction that we are Americanized, and so we have a history as part of that in the immigration and coming over and all that we did, and you know, even for Western New York here, you know, we oftentimes point to the canal and you know, the Irish immigrants that dug the canal, and you know, you can get into a controversy there about whether they did or they didn't. Many hold that it wasn't the Irish, that it was local labor, and some say, well, it was obviously the Irish, and when in fact, both those statements are true. When they started the canal, they did want to use just local labor, and you know, as we know, they started in Rome, New York. They went east and they went west, but the further west that they went, the less populated the state was, and it was mostly wilderness. So when they get up to near the end, up in Niagara County, there was no labor pool for them to draw on. And so that's when the Irish immigration, the further west they go, the more they needed the laborers. And, you know, the immigrants would work cheap, and so they did that. And so when they got to the Niagara Escarpment, where they had to get up and into the Niagara Escarpment to finish it to go to Lake Erie and do all that cutting, that's when a big push of Irish immigration came. What happened is that these laborers could then send money home, when most of the Irish peoples, the Irish Catholics in particular, could not afford to come over. They were tenant farmers. And so when people were getting a foothold here in the United States and they'd send money back to Ireland, then they could immigrate. And so that started a wave coming this way. And so the Erie Canal was a big part of that. And we know that was, you know, 1817 is when they started, 1825 when they finished it. So now we have this wave coming in. And then when the famine years hit, which was 1845 to 1852, and they were forced to come out, a lot of them still didn't have the money to do that, but at least it gave them a destination. And it gave them, you know, this was open land. You could get land cheap. And so, and some Irish were here, and they were open and welcoming to their brethren Irishmen. So this whole Western New York area, when we settled as Irish, came, and the canal was a big part of that. And so it was early on local labor. But like I say, you know, the further west they got, the more the immigrants had a foothold in that. So this whole area, and including the Canandaigua and, you know, the Finger Lakes region, were settled by the Irish. And, you know, they were farmers by employment. I mean, that was what they did. And they, like I said, they were tenant farmers, cottiers, what they called them. And so when they came to this area, I mean, farming was what they knew. And so that's what they did. And
Can you speak on the indentured servant that they were known for when they first got here?
Right.
Known for and subjected to.
Well, we might get into some ugly history here.
I like people to understand the truth of, you know, I'll say the plight of the Irishman, uh-huh. But it was extremely difficult. They were looked down upon. Yeah. I want to throw in there the fact that they also had a big part with building the railroad.
Oh, they did, yes. After the canal, the railroad, you know, the railroad came into its heyday, you know, and so those laborers either transformed into that, they moved west to do other canals, but your question about the indentured servants, and they come in, and if they had to leave Ireland for whatever condition, and Ireland had a number of famines. It wasn't, we know of the big one, like I mentioned, 1845 to 52, but there were other ones. And so as they came over, they didn't have the wherewithal. They were lucky just to get enough to have a passage on a ship and have nothing when they got here. And when they come into the harbors, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and other than whatever they did in Ireland, mostly a farming trade, and now they're into a city, and they were willing to work for less than anybody else, so they did become indentured servants. And what I say the ugly piece of this is, you know, the Irish have been in America since day one. You know, since we started settling in here. But what those early Irish were the Protestant Irish, because they had the wherewithal. They were business people. They could come over. They could set up trades and do stuff like that. So a lot of the early Irish in America and then what became the United States was the Protestant Irish. So, because the Irish Catholics couldn't afford to do that. So now when this transformation comes in the 1800s, and the Irish Catholics start coming in, and quite frankly, they clashed with the existing Irish Protestant. So those old world biases ended up on the soil here. And so a lot of businesses wouldn't hire the Irish. You know, Irish need not apply was a frequent sign, you know, for shops, you know, along the coastlines as these Irish were coming in. So they had to take these indentured servants type jobs, laborers, and they had to pull up their bootstraps to assimilate into our society, which they did. And they got involved in the political machine, which was it. And that was something that was so foreign to them, because in Ireland, they didn't have the vote. They didn't have representation. They didn't have a voice. But they come here to America, and they could vote. You know, once they got settled in here, and, you know, obviously that was the men early on, that before the women had the right to vote.
Right.
And so, but that was all a process that was new to them. So they became a powerful political force, especially in New York, and we know about Tanami Hall
in Boston
and all those
cities. Yeah,
you know, so they were a political force to be reckoned with, and so they did rise up, and you know, and here we are today.
Right.
That's interesting. I never thought about the fact that our politics were foreign to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they didn't even have that kind of voting or political.
Right.
System back then. So an indentured servant would come over here owing whoever brought them over money, right?
If that's the way they came, yes. Yeah.
And that was very dangerous to them, because if they couldn't produce and make that the person who picked up their loan any money, they were considered, I believe, the loan the loan guy who picked up the loan, his property close to it.
Well, yes. I mean, that's servitude defined. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, right. And and that's another part of the ugly history. You know, what happens then? You know.
And another part of my, you know, I do kind of focus in on both the good and the bad. I was having a chat with a friend of mine who's African-American, and he's a black activist, mm-hmm. and he posed the question, when else in history has there ever been cartoons drawn of a heritage or a culture of people than the cartoons that they would draw of black people in a very racist time in America? And it was funny that he would say that, and he would say it in a forum that I'm at, because here, if I can find it, Melissa, you can catch it on the mic if I can, or the camera. I have to figure out where I was. Give me one second. Talk about something Irish.
Okay. Well, maybe what you're going to lead into is some of the cartoon characteristics that came out of England and, you know, the London papers depicting the Irish. And they were not complimentary at all. And I think that's probably where you're going.
Can you come up, Mike, with the camera? So here's, like, one of the ultimate in... Oh, yeah, this is... I think Freud had a lot to do with this. The psychopathic horror, the Irish. And then one of my least favorites... is look at the mug on this guy, right? They give us that look.
Right, and that was very typical of the cartoon caricatures at that time.
And then also you get into stuff like this where, well, I'd never noticed before, but he's holding a knife. And they give him this with a bottle of booze, whiskey down here. So it was a hard time for us to come from these type of cartoons and, you know, the way that they looked at us. But I don't think people realize that we were very close to a sub-level of culture brought into America. And we had, it's not that we were sub-level, but we had to prove that we were not by getting into politics, by getting into law enforcement, by owning property. And we assimilated into a culture that, and we had to prove ourselves, prove our worthiness, our intelligence, everything.
Well, and that's correct. And you know, that probably speaks to a lot of the immigration coming in, certainly through the 19th century, early 20th century. You know, after that, the Italians came in. Now, they spoke a different language, as did Germans and French and Polish and all that. So they had an extra level to overcome. Not to say that the Irish... I mean, two words out of an Irishman's mouth, and you knew he was from Ireland. And so he had to change his verbiage and how he spoke to assimilate as well, and to say, not announce either in any way, shape, or form that he was Irish. He had to become Americanized. All immigrants felt they had to become Americanized to be accepted.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you have anybody in history that you're kind of like a read on that you're proud of that is the example of success?
Oh my goodness!
For being Irish.
Well, thank you very much for asking. Well, I my heritage is we come in through Canada in 1825.
Same as my grandfather.
And we were part of the Peter Robinson Settlement Project. Peter Robinson was a Canadian official, and they asked if he would bring over Irish out of Southern Ireland. Now, I spoke of famines, other famines, and there was a famine in 1821, 1822, but it was more isolated to Southern Ireland. It was the potato crop, but it was a different virus than the one that affected 20 years later.
You know, I got to interject. You know, we call it the famine to be polite, mm-hmm. but it really was a poisoning of the crops by the British to lessen the population of the Irish.
Well, they let it go. I mean, yeah. You know, I mean, we could get into to what all that meant, but the fact is the potato crop did fail,
right.
And it left people starving, and
absolutely,
and it was the political response to that. That's the horror of it all. But in the early 1820s, there was a crop failure, and the people in Southern Ireland and County Cork is which we're from. The British government said, we've got to do something about this. So they asked Peter Robinson, the Canadian official, if he would bring over the Irish. And he did. He did two waves. He did one in 1823, which was only about 600 people. And he did a second wave 2 years later in 1825, which was much larger. It was 2,000 Irish that he brought over. And he settled them in Upper Canada. And that's the wave that we were part of. And what he did is he commissioned 9 ships to bring over these 2,000. And the deal was that they would bring them over. They would give them land. They would give them a shanty. And they would give them 70 acres. And if they stayed on the land and they were productive, they would land grant them another 30 acres. So in essence, they were giving them 100 acres of land, which was
phenomenal
for them. Great. Now, it's wilderness, and they're going to have to clear it. And he had to do a little bit of selling of let's go to Canada out of Ireland, of which, you know, the Irish wouldn't have known that much about it. And anything they would have heard probably would be where our mind goes quickly. It's cold there. And, you know, and so, but, I mean, they were destitute. So they did. And after the 1823 one, and Peter Robinson lived up to everything he promised, when he went back to Ireland 2 years later to do the second one, and he said, you know, who wants to go to Canada? 50,000 people applied to go to Canada, and he was just amazed. But his reputation had prevailed, and they knew he was good to his word. So he had to whittle that 50,000 people down to 2,000, and that's what he brought over.
That's hard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, not just the math, but the what do you want to call it? The well, no, you're inside. You know, you have to make that awful decision saying you're still going to stay there, but you I allow in.
Right. Kind of like Sophie's Choice, where you're saying, which of my children am I going to have killed?
So, right. Yeah. Well, he set up a criteria. And, you know, he was thinking, this: what do I want to bring to Canada? And so he said it had to be a family unit. The head of household couldn't be any more than 45 years old. They had to be Catholic. Now, here's Peter Robinson. He's an Anglican. And he's over in Ireland. And he's saying, the Catholics got to go. And he said, because they're the issue here. They're the ones that's starving. He says, you Protestants are not going to get a free ride to America. Not on me or not. He says, it's the Catholics. So, I mean, he was an amazing thing that he did. And so he brought them over, and he started clearing the land. He stayed with them. Part of the deal was that he would not only give them the land, a shanty, but he'd give them a cow. And he'd give them enough food to last 1 year. And after that first year, they were on their own. And so he did that. And remember, this is all at the expense of the British government, which...
Is this in Canada or in a place in America?
This is in Canada.
In Canada.
What's the modern name of where it is?
Okay. Well, after the Irish got there and they settled, and they were so appreciative of what Peter Robinson did for them, they renamed the town. It was known as Scott's Mills when they brought him over. And it was Upper Canada, present-day Ontario. They renamed the town after Peter Robinson. So we know it today as Peterborough, Ontario.
No kidding.
And so if you go to Peterborough, it's a big Irish settlement. A lot of the families still stay there and have farmed the area. Now, you know, it's the surrounding townships in that area that he settled them. And, some of their descendants ended up here in the United States, which here I am. So that's our history. So when you ask, you know, can I point to a hero? I can point to a Anglican, British-aligned hero. Peter Robinson, he is my hero for what he did.
That's nice.
It is, and that doesn't get... I mean, it was such a successful immigration scheme. But it doesn't get that much notoriety. I mean, certainly the people in Peterborough know that history. Because what Peter did, he went over budget, and the British government said, we can't do this anymore. So they stopped it. But what happened? What was the fallout from that? The fallout was that these people came in and they set up these farms. They were productive. They could send money back. They could say, I have an area that we can point to where you can come and you can be successful. So there was another point for immigration, and this is coming through Canada, of where did they come in. And so we know a lot of Irish came to Canada and through Canada to here. So that's the Peter Robinson story in 1825.
Let me ask you another question that I think a lot of people want to know. You know, McDougall or Mac or O, I'll say O. Thornton because I actually tried to do that when I was a kid. I didn't think my name was Irish enough, Thornton, so I made it. This is like not even 8th grade, 7th grade or something. I changed my name to O. Thornton just on my paperwork. And the school said, oh, we made a mistake, and they changed all their records to O. Thornton. And when my dad came, like, you know, maybe 6 months later or something, he came around, he wanted to take me out of school for the day. They wouldn't let him. Uh-huh. They said, I'm sorry, your license doesn't match O. Thornton. And so he had to prove that I'm really not.
And so many wanted to drop the O in the MC.
So what does the O and the Mick and the Mac, I believe it means something. It's not mm-hmm. really part of the last name. It's more like a surtitle?
It is a surtitle. And, you know, it's, I mean, originally, if we go back far, we're the Carthys, which they don't really pronounce the H in Irish language. So it would be the Carthys, and then the son would be the Mick Carthy. So the MC would indicate the son of Carthy. And so, and the O, it's a different strain. I don't know if it's the Saxon strain or the Scottish strain of that side of it, where the O was the indication of the sire, you know.
And you talked about Peter Richard's son, right? And so the English did the same thing, but they put their son on the end.
Right.
Because it would have been Peter Richard, and then the son of Peter Richard would be Peter Richardson.
Right. Right.
Oh, so it doesn't have anything to do with, like, land ownership, the sir part? Or it just has just the lineage of where you're kind of from?
To my knowledge, it's just a lineage. That it wouldn't be tied back to land ownership because, well, they lost the land, you know, right. And when, you know, after the Cromwell invasion in 1649, and then after the Battle of Boyne with William of Orange, and that solidified England ran Ireland, and that happened in 1690. So after that, they didn't own land. The lands were taken from them, and they were given as bounty to the lot of the army generals and army officers, and so they took over the land. So then they became the tenant farmers rather than the owners.
So the Mac would be of a Scottish lineage. What about the Mick part, MC? What do you think that was more of?
Well, Ireland itself is a mixture of immigration, if you go back far enough. I mean, big Viking influences back, 1000s, when the Vikings landed there. Of course, you have the English and the Saxon influences and stuff like that. And, in what I would call more recent history, moving up into the 1600s, you have the Spanish influence to Ireland. So, but I don't think that ties back to the MC, the Mick part of it. I think it goes back much more to Saxon, maybe even Viking influence, and maybe even going back to the Druids, and that's going back farther than we can even define here.
Farther than pen to parchment,
Yeah. Well, pre St. Patrick, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I like that stuff because people always want to know what that means, you know, or why do you have the Mick or the Mac or the O? I didn't know O was part of the Saxon leading to the Vikings. That's interesting.
Well, I can't say that for definite sure, but I, yeah, you know, I know that it is kind of a different heritage line of which that came in. Yeah, right.
That's great. Can you tell us more?
Like, let's talk a little bit about St. Patrick, because everybody thinks St. Patrick's an Irishman.
Well, no, he was British, and if you look at his lineage, he's Roman. But he went to Ireland as an indentured servant. He was sent there, and he eventually escaped. He went in as a young man, but then as he got older, he went back to England, and then he studied Catholicism, and then eventually went back to Ireland, and
by his free choice.
By free choice.
Yeah.
Yes. So he then started the conversion. I mean, it was a very pagan country at that point. A lot of Druid, superstitious type stuff. And he used, you know, we all know how he used the shamrock to show the Trinity, you know, the three-leaf clover and bring the that into the Catholicism and the Trinity and stuff like that. So... And we know the rest is history with that. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's really fair to say that St. Patrick had such a great influence on the country of Ireland that basically Ireland became a Catholic country.
Well, it did. It became a very solid Catholic country. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And then, after Henry VIII and the Elizabethan times, England turned Protestant and stuff like that, and then the Scots came over into Northern Ireland. And, you know, Elizabeth I, I mean, she set up a settlement in Northern Ireland, the Ulster settlement. And so then that introduces the Protestants to a Catholic country, to a very solid. And so they tried to influence and actually exterminate Catholicism out of Ireland. It didn't work, but they tried it, and that's why they didn't have the vote. That's why they couldn't own land. I mean, that was the old penal laws set up by the British government that, you're a nobody if you don't swear allegiance to the Church of England and the Crown. And if you don't do those two things, you know, you're subhuman.
Wow. Yeah. So let me ask you this. This is my collection of both Irish walking sticks and a shillelagh.
Mm-hmm.
How am I doing so far?
You're doing good.
So this one I actually use.
Mm-hmm.
It's my favorite one. I'll show you. I carry that around. I drive down the road, and I get to just put my hand on it. It makes me feel good. It seems to fit. I don't know a lot about this, but there's something to do. Oh, not with this one. Of course, this is made out of blackthorn.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this one's a blonde.
Yeah.
Out of a rosewood. And then I assume this is blackthorn, just not as attractive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this has ever been painted, but it almost looks like it could have. So maybe they are painted.
Well, what they used to do is they would put them into the chimneys, and it would be the soot.
Color the wood.
Well, it would color the wood, but it would preserve it as well. In the chimney. Yeah, they would place it in there.
Why don't you get the camera a little closer to? So,
well, if you don't mind, I would like to inspect it to see if it's a true shillelagh.
Oh, I'm nervous. Okay.
Okay. Well, it's got to have specks of blood in there.
This one is the one. Now, I got this from a black gentleman who bought it from an Irish family,
mm-hmm.
who said they had it for well over 100 years. And, you know, probably was an estate sale or something like that. And my grandfather had one, but the very day he passed, one of the 14 aunts or uncles, and we know who you are, by the way, broke into the house, probably had a key, and went right to the cabinet and took the family shillelagh. is what they refer to it. But I believe that this is really a shillelagh. This is really an Irish walking stick. But this one, this is the one
that do harm.
You see how it just fits, right?
And there's so people on the radio can't see how it.
Well,
fits.
They got to go to the. Oh, yeah, I get what you're doing. So, right, if you go to the film on our live Facebook, you can see it. But there's some part. Now, this wasn't made for me, but it has to measure from your elbow to your hand, so that it fits in a certain way that you can actually use it for fighting. It's more of almost like the beginning of a billy club, the beginning of, say, a nunchuck. It's actually meant to be for your hand. So I don't know if this guy was very tall or very short, because I don't know how it works, but there is an actual art of shillelagh fighting. But I only let the Irish touch this. And this almost got me in trouble once with a female trooper, because the other trooper says, hey, you want to touch a shillelagh, you're Irish. And she turned around and had a look on her face like, I'm going to get tased and dropped. And he went, I go, this. And she goes, oh, and then she couldn't wait to come over and touch it, because it is really a shillelagh. So careful how you make that joke.
But, well, yes, because people do know it's a weapon.
It is a weapon.
It is a weapon, yes. Wow. It's got some heft to it, you know. Let me see if there's any specks of blood in this one.
There's definitely some notches. So specks of blood.
Probably notches in a few people's heads, too.
Well, if you watch the old movies, like the old black and white movies and stuff, people in England, when they all had to decide they were going to have a brawl in the street, they ran out of the houses with these, too. Now, maybe they were the Irish people in England. But I noticed that I was kind of, that the English had their share of clubs like this, too.
I am sure.
So that's my little collection so far.
Very nice. Yes.
Yeah, it's I think it's hard to find this. There was a guy who had one like this, and it went for kind of off market, like flea market to military collectors, for $400.
Wow.
And the guy was willing to pay that and sell it for more. And so everybody was walking up to me going, you know, your stick is worth $400. And I said, look, I'm telling you right now, it's worth $18. You know, that's what I paid for it. Maybe it is worth, you know, more than that, but not to that extent. Well, it turns out I was kind of wrong. So the walking stick that the other gentleman had and sold was a Civil War era walking stick, Irish, with Irish script, they said, written into it, and that's what made it worth $325 more.
Yeah,
I'm surprised that's all. That's all it was worth.
Oh, I think they'll sell it for a profit.
Yeah.
So yeah. So now I understand, but it actually caused a price war on shillelaghs between Avon, all the way up to Clarence in Buffalo.
Oh,
they, for 2 or 3 weeks. No matter where I went, people are like, do you understand what that's worth? I go, not mine. And you're not buying it.
Nice collection.
Very nice. So how would you like to tell people a little bit about how to find you and where to reach out for the Irish-American culture?
Well, the Irish-American Cultural Institute, I suppose, would be the best way to reach us via our web page, and that is RochesterIACI.org. And on there, all about the membership, but we post our upcoming events. And so come to any event. They are not closed, so they're open to anybody that wants to come. There's a link for an application there. And then eventually you get on our email list, and you know, we send out email blasts at upcoming events, and so that's the easiest and the best way to do it. RochesterIACI.org.
And you're going to be in the upcoming parade this weekend?
I am going to be in the upcoming parade. I'm the Grand Marshal.
Don't
yes.
they give you like one of them big sticks to carry or something? Like a what are they? No, a baton. The one the band leader uses?
That would be a baton.
No. No, I have a banner that.
Oh, you got the banner.
Yeah, it says Grand Marshal banner. No, I'm not Miss America. Don't confuse me.
When I did the debate for the district attorneys, I still can't believe I got away with this. I stood up there with this beard and this shillelagh dictating how the rules were going to go. And people didn't really see it, but you could clearly see it on film. I'm holding it like this. Mm-hmm. Not like I was really going to, you know, give someone the... But I think you should have, like, some kind of stick.
Oh, I have a walking stick.
Oh, you should carry it then with you.
I do, yes. Are you gonna from my grandfather. So.
Yeah, that should be with you in the parade.
Well, I
just for, not for threatening, but just because it's part of your Now, is your walking stick for your father more like this or like this?
It's like this, but it's not blackened.
Oh, more like
maybe this color here.
Oh, the guy told me that this was the blonde.
Yeah.
The rosewood. Yeah. And I didn't know anything about that at all. But
it's
pretty.
But it's thicker with the knob at the top. Yeah. Yeah.
Anybody any reason why we can't be raising blackthorn in America and producing these sticks? Because I think that's a business right there.
Okay, would blackthorn be like an invasive species?
I don't know. It doesn't seem like it's around. It's, you know, it's a thorn bush.
The fact that it's not around may be a good thing. Maybe if they brought it over here and planted it, it would take over and it, you know, would drive out other species. So you have to be careful with stuff like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
Yes. Michael McCarthy?
McCarthy, yes.
Yeah, good. And from the Irish American Cultural Institute in Rochester, New York chapter. And we hope to see you again. It was great having you on the show.
Well, thank you, and come on down to the parade.
That's right. Thanks, everybody. Well, how do you say anything Irish-ish sounding on the way out? Maybe a proverb or...
Oh.
Putting you on the spot.
You are putting me on the spot. Well, the old, may the road rise up to meet you, and...
The sun's always at your back.
The sun's always at your back, but all that good feeling that the Irish bring to you.
Great. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
Welcome back, and this is Three Men and a Microphone, WKR, 1310 AM. And this is Three Men and a Mic with Mike Yarger, Armin Marinetti, Melissa Walker, and Corporal Tim Thornton.
And we're opening up with Candego 2020.
Top of the morning, and this is Saturday, St. Patrick's Day.
And
isn't it?
Yeah, matter of fact, I think St. Patrick's Day does end up on
you
the
17th. You want to see another thing my bookie gave me?
Oh, no. Another thing your bookie gave you. So
she gives me gifts all the time. This little...
your bookie, who also happens to be a good bookkeeper.
Right. This little... it's a fire pot. You put it by your fire to keep warm. Like you use it to stick in the fuel, like kerosene or something, and then you pull that stick out. And then you take it over to the fireplace, and you light it and light your kindling.
Wow.
She gave me an Irish penny that she found. Huh. I don't know if you can...
How do you know it's Irish?
Oh, you can see the little...
leprechaun on it.
Well, it's not so lucky.
Not a leprechaun. It's a little harp.
Oh.
On this side right here. There it goes.
Oh, yeah.
So that's my new... I have to draw luck from different things. So this brings me luck. My Iwo Jima ring from World War II that was made out of trench art. And that was made probably for a Marine that has probably already since passed. And my gunnery sergeant ball wrist... you know, like the Vietnam identifier for people that have passed in, you know, MIA.
MIA.
He's not MIA, but he died during the Iraq War.
Right, POW MIA bracelets.
Yep.
Right?
I had to have all three of those on to get through the day.
So now that Tim has gotten us off topic, let's get back on topic and start with Candego 2020.
I thought that pot was filled with gold.
Tim's a little...
Now that Armand has got us off topic, let's talk about a topic? Yeah, let's talk about events.
Go ahead.
Yeah, what's going on this weekend?
Let's talk about events that are coming up.
Okay.
All right. And Armin, you want to start us off? You said you've got something from American Legion.
Over at the American Legion Post 256 here on North Main Street in Canandaigua, we have our monthly Sons of the Legion breakfast starts at 8:30, goes to 11 o'clock. It's $8, all you can eat. It includes biscuits and sausage, gravy, mashed potatoes, home fries, bacon.
Not fried potatoes?
Home fries. Yeah, those are fried.
Not mashed.
Not mashed.
You said mashed.
Did I say mashed?
That's what I heard, mashed
potatoes. I'm sorry, that was a mistake.
Right.
Home fries. Thank you, Tim, for catching me on that. See?
Well, that would have been, you know, odd combination.
Yeah, you don't... Right. Yeah.
We didn't think of a chicken fried steak, mashed potatoes, but in this case, it's sausage gravy over your fried potatoes.
I just made a mistake.
let me tell you about this breakfast, because I've been trying to get there. Last month, I got there.
Yeah.
This breakfast was so good. And I got to say, the bacon, perfect. There was tons of bacon. Not just, oh, Tim, have a couple, you know, broken bits. No, it was the perfect kind of bacon where you can bite into it, you know, not snap it in your mouth.
Yeah.
That, and there was plenty of it. There was no shortage of bacon. No shortage of the home fries that were cooked probably in the bacon fat. And a sausage gravy was made the kind
of... He's got my mouth
was,
watering
the
here.
The sausage gravy was obviously made with real sausage and bacon grease because it didn't have that pure white look. It had that off-white, which is usually homemade gravy, which they did confirm. And then they had the big fluffy eggs and the biscuits and hot coffee. And I tried to make them take a loss. I ate at least two plates, but I couldn't eat more.
Wow.
And it is the Sunday after St. Patrick's Day, the 18th, so nobody feels like making breakfast after St. Patrick's Day.
That's true. It's a good way to come into town.
Yeah, put your feet up, have a cup of coffee.
And that starts how early?
Starts at 8:30.
8:30, so not too early.
Nope, and we go to 11. Usually get our after-church crowd coming in, you know, between 10:30. You know, that.
Lots of parking up there at the Legion, both in the front
and
in the back.
Out back, yep. And then a week from Sunday.
The following week.
It would be the 25th, March 25th. We're holding a country jamboree and music festival. Entry for that is admission is $5.
Is this still at the Legion?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is at the Legion. There's going to be about, I think, 3 to 4 different bands there. Starts at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, goes to about 6:30 at night. The bar will be open for customers, so you can get an adult beverage there at a reasonable price if you wish. I guess they did this about 4 years ago. This is before I was involved, and they had a really good turnout. So they're doing this again as a fundraiser, so we'll have monies available to help the veterans and active duty military people in our community.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Nice.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yep.
Okay. These are some of the other events we've got coming up. Canandaigua's Polar Plunge. You know, we have that.
Cole, just
people
think about it.
People are going to be going down to Kershaw Park.
God bless them.
And going into the water down there. When? Saturday, March 24th, the day before the music festival up at the Legion. The plunge actually occurs at noon. Registration is from 10 to 11:30. And I know there's a lot of teams out there, and they're out raising funds for Special Olympics. So it's important. I mean, this is a good cause that it's going towards. But you won't find me.
What's the cause? Oh, Special Olympics.
Special Olympics, right. But you won't find me putting even a toe in that water.
They can come to the country jamboree and dance so they can warm up after
there
being in the lake.
Well, I have to wait till the next day because this is Saturday. Yours is Sunday. So also, the Canandaigua Chamber of Commerce is hosting their annual legislative luncheon. That's on Friday, March 23rd. So that's the day before the Polar Plunge. That's from 12 to 1:30 at the Inn on the Lake, and the chamber is bringing in Brian Kolb and Pam Helming. So they'll be talking about what we can expect to see coming out of Albany when and if they end up passing a budget. So, and I mean, I'll give Cuomo credit. We have had budgets pass pretty much on time for the last number of years. So under his, I'm going to use the term, leadership. Moving on.
Did you see the picture of Cuomo laying on his back in the middle of the school?
I did see that.
Between the students.
With all the students.
So if active shooters running around, you get to lay down on your butt, and like you're laying down in a mass grave. Yeah, he did that.
I saw that.
I saw the video.
Yeah. So we have Pastome. They've gotten together with the city of Canandaigua, and they're offering a workshop on a program to make improvements in home efficiency. So they'll actually assist you in paying for insulating your home, for upgrading your windows, your doors, things of that nature. But you have to attend their workshop, and that's going to be Wednesday, April 4th, 6:30 p.m. at the Wood Library. And I encourage people to attend this because in previous years they've had these workshops and they don't get enough people in attendance to take advantage of this. And so there's monies that are left on the table. And that's a terrible shame because we're just pouring money into RG&E and National Grid, and you know, we really need to do a better job about conserving our power. So Pastome, Canandaigua City are getting together to help you do that.
I conserve power every day.
Well, I know you do. We come in here and we freeze our butts off.
Well, besides that, I just try to do as little as possible every day.
All right, Tim. Kiwanis, great organization, and every year they put on an Easter egg hunt. And theirs is going to be Saturday, March 24th, same day, incidentally, as Polar Plunge at 10 a.m. Now, the interesting thing about their Easter egg hunt is that it's wheelchair accessible. And they have thousands of eggs that they put out there, and the kids go and run for their eggs, and they have different age groups that go out at different times. So very well organized, very well run, and good time is had by all. I hear there might be an appearance by some giant 6-foot Easter bunny or something like that. So yeah, really. And that's not the only Easter egg hunt.
Why does that sound more frightening than good? The 6-foot Easter bunny.
A great big white with fluffy ears. I don't know why that'd be frightening.
Is his name Harvey? You remember that movie with Jimmy Stewart?
Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Good reference. So that's not the only Easter egg hunt there is. Paula Sowersby. Now, you guys probably don't know Paula. She's a very interesting lady. And what makes her so interesting is here's a woman who should be dead. Right? And I don't say that lightly. This is a woman who has a heart condition where her aortic vein has twice disintegrated to the point where she's bleeding out, right? Ooh. And they've made the repair and brought her back. And it's extremely rare to be able to do it once. She's had it done twice.
Wow.
So here's a woman who could pass away tomorrow. And she knows this. And she lives with this condition. And what she does is she runs a ton of PIFs. And what are PIFs? They're paying it forward.
Oh.
Okay? So she has people pick number from 1 to 100. Let's say 45 is the number. And somebody picks 45, and she'll give them a gift. And it might be a gift card to some store, or it might be, you know, some Tim Hortons Timbits or something like that. But she does this on a regular basis. And this is the second annual Easter egg hunt that she's putting on for the community. This is going to occur Saturday, March 31st. So it's 1 week after the Kiwanis Easter egg hunt. So you can actually go to both if you have a child. This one happens at the Levi Courser Park, which is in the town of Bristol. So, you know, County Road 64, as you head towards Bristol Mountain, you come into Bristol, and then there's County Road 32, also known as the Bristol Road, which cuts across that. You're going to take a right on the County Road 32, and then this Levi Courser Park is just a little ways down on your left.
Okay.
So that's where that one's going on. And that's our list of events for this year.
I have one more event.
And you Melissa has an mic? Event for us. So she's coming to the mic, and I'm grabbing the camera. And
March 31st, 5th Chapter Motorcycle Club, where you met Scotty, is putting a benefit spaghetti dinner from 3:30 to 7 at the Moose Lodge in Palmyra, New York. And all the proceeds go towards the Vets in Recovery program.
And if you're looking for tickets, you can contact Melissa. I think Melissa has a few tickets, don't
you? Yes, $10 each or $15 at the door.
$10.
And they're also giving, they're doing a raffle for first prize is a 60-inch 4K television. Second prize is a 50-inch 4K television. And the third prize is a $100 gift certificate to a greenhouse.
To a greenhouse?
A greenhouse.
Oh, so you can get your plants going.
Yep.
Good time of year.
How do they get hold of you?
Military surplus.
No, give them your email or something.
My email? I don't want creepers calling.
Well, when you figure it out, come back and
No, it's mjspringston@yahoo.com, or you can call me or text me at 585-455-4844. And again, all the proceeds go towards the Vets in Recovery. And as a vet myself that's also in recovery, it's a great program. And it's the only motorcycle club in the area that does this for the vets.
That's great. Thanks, Melissa.
You're welcome.
So let's move on to the news. And we had an interesting meeting last night that, Tim, I was surprised I didn't see you at. This meeting was with the town of Canandaigua, and they're talking about Uptown Canandaigua. Where's Uptown Canandaigua? I've never heard of that before. Well, Uptown Canandaigua starts at Tops and runs out to the Acoustics.
Oh, so I'm Uptown.
So you're Uptown. Did you know that?
Where's the Acoustics?
Yeah, Acoustics is a former, what did they call it before? Infotonics was one name for it.
Oh.
They've had multiple names for that facility up there. A facility with a bunch of green rooms and things of this nature.
Huh.
So they had this charrette, we're going to call it. And they brought all these people together and they said, okay, let's talk about this area of the city, Uptown. And what plans do we want to make for this area in the future? And what's your perception of the area and things like that? Well, you and I both drive down through this section all the time. So we kind of are pretty well aware of what's going on in the area and what businesses are here and like that. And a lot of the people's perceptions were car dealerships, right? We have a fair share of car dealerships in the area. And that's not anything bad. I mean, car dealers need to have places where they can sell their cars, and that's not necessarily bad, but it does make it kind of an interesting transition to go from the rural area, you know, Farmington area, where you see farms on both sides, into Uptown, and then head in toward downtown Canandaigua. So they're saying, let's look at this. We've got, I don't know, $80,000 or some astronomical amount of money that the government has given us to study this area. And let's make a plan about what we'd like to see there for the next 20 years. So they're at the very beginning stages of this. And if you have some great ideas about what you'd like to see in this area, feel free to contact anybody at the town. I mean, just about everybody was there. We saw the supervisor. We saw the people on the town board. We saw the assistant supervisor. We saw director of planning. We saw the guy from Parks and Rec. Just about everybody in the town was there last night. So contact any one of them. Let them know what your thoughts are for what you'd like to see occurring in this Uptown area.
I'd like to ask them. I'm going to have to make one of these meetings because I want to know what they can do about getting rid of the white stuff and the cold weather this time of year. I want to see sunshine and 70 year round.
No, you have to go down. You have to go downtown to see that. Right, Uptown.
Well, we got those ski mountains on 332 that we get to go up and down.
Yeah, right, ski mountains.
I got that little Joel song in my head now.
Oh, right by the mic, huh?
I have that Billy Joel song in my head now, Uptown Girl.
Uptown Girl. So I like the idea that they've branded this area Uptown. I think that gives it a nice ring. And if they turn it into a commercial hub where there's people walking out on the streets here all the time and riding bicycles and stopping into the merchants and supporting them, good.
I said it last week. You need to connect the sidewalks.
Right.
Connect the sidewalks so people can go through Uptown Canandaigua at a leisurely pace. They don't have to go in and out of the highway. That'll create more flow, actually walk-in traffic.
And actually, that was one of the suggestions that was brought up. But you should reinforce it when you get a chance by talking to some of the folks over at the town.
Make a nice little dog walk trail, you know. Because there are guys that do walk their dogs up and down there. Some guy with, I think, beautiful-looking... I don't know, they're kind of like reddish hounds. I don't know what breed that is. But he's always up here on the sidewalks over by that hardware store. Tractor Supply.
Okay.
I think, and down.
Okay.
By the Trooper Barracks.
Yeah.
In between there. Anyways, go ahead.
Yeah, that Red Hound is probably an Irish setter.
didn't have long hair.
No? Oh, okay.
A Russian Vizsla.
Could be. All right. So that's interesting as you talk about the dogs.
What's that?
That's interesting you talk about the dogs. Because it turns out this week the town has said that they're going to give some money to the city to support the dog park. And the dog park, when the folks got together to plan this dog park, they approached the town and they said, you know, we'd like you to assist us with this. And the town was like, no way. Out here in the town, all of our people have lots of property. We got acres and acres of land. Why the heck would we want to take our dogs to some park to have them run around? We've got acres for them to run around on. Well, it turns out that there's a lot of people in town that don't have acres. They've got the hammocks that have been built. They have the veterans housing up here, and there's people there that have dogs. And so actually there's a great interest from the citizens of the town in using the dog park that's being built. The city put $60,000 towards the park to have it constructed, and the town said, okay, look, we'll put $30,000 in, and you'll treat the residents of the town the same way residents of the city. So city residents have to pay $25-$30 for a membership, same thing with the town, and you'll allow the town folks with their dogs to be able to use the same park. And so it's a win-win all the way around. And I love to see this cooperation between the city and the town, because it's not something that we've seen a lot of previously. So that was one incident.
I mean, I'd have to get political, but I think the town works excellent with the city. Sharing equipment, sharing buildings. You always hear how they work together a lot.
But that did not used to be the case.
Well, couple of years.
Yeah, couple of years it's been different.
Who's in charge now? It's important to know that then.
Right. So we still have the same mayor.
Right.
Well, have the same mayor in the city of Canandaigua. That's Ellen Palmini. She's been here for a long time.
Right. But the town is always reaching out to help out.
Right. And that's Greg Westbrook.
Yep. There you go.
Right. And he actually shares a duty with the day-to-day guy, who happens to be Doug Finch. So those guys are the ones who are making this stuff happen. And so we applaud them for that.
Can I interrupt for a minute about Mr. Westbrook? Because
sure.
I saw this. They have a newsletter. The town put out a newsletter.
Yes, they do.
And the feature article in the newsletter is that he is considered a part-time town supervisor.
That's correct.
So he took a reduction in pay from $56,000 down to $20,000.
Wow.
That's a $36,000 reduction in pay,
right?
Because he's part time.
He didn't even half it. He went more than half.
Yes, yes. Now they do have Doug Finch as
right.
the town manager,
right? And he's a day to day guy who
yes.
runs the town.
Yeah, which probably used up that $36,000,
right?
And of course, our favorite Tina Bloom. She is now the Deputy town supervisor.
Correct. So she fills in for Greg Westbrook when he's out of town.
And she only works for a stipend. It was mentioned in the newsletter.
$2,000
a year.
Year.
Yeah.
Right. So they got her cheap.
Yeah.
So three people for less than the price of one.
Yeah. Right.
Good job. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Good.
Or no.
Nope. No. That.
Well,
that
what does Finch make?
Good question. I can only guess. I'm not going to.
Oh,
I'm not going
to
venture. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not going to venture a guess.
But basically what this does is Greg Westbrook becomes the contact for the town on the Board of Supervisors, Ontario County Board of Supervisors. So he's able to work those connections with the other towns in the area,
mm-hmm.
where he doesn't have to worry about the day-to-day managing of the town of Canandaigua. That's taken care of by Doug Finch.
Mm-hmm.
And those are really two very different skill sets. And I think each of these guys is well-served in doing the jobs that they do. So
tune in every Saturday morning, 8 to 10 a.m., for three men and a microphone and a lady. Hear all about local news, politics, fishing report, and sports, as well as all the talk about town and the scuttlebutt in the city. To keep up on the show, stay connected and visit us on Facebook at Canandaigua 1310, Three Men and a Microphone. Presented each week
Saturday, 8 to 10 a.m., and Sunday afternoons at 2 p.m. Sponsored by the Military Exchange in Canandaigua, New York. And to catch up on past episodes, go to IronMikesMX.com or WOKR 1310.